Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 88, section 4, which is old single column, page 970. Okay, so we got through the first block of this paper. Paper is basically in two halves. That first half, where we are focusing specifically on fetishism and how that was, to begin with, an augmentation of the ghost cult. But it opened itself up to a more natural mode of abstract thinking, and hence began to generalize beyond just merely being part of the details of how the ghost cult works. Okay. And then the second half of this paper is about magic, which is going to take it yet another step to further abstraction. You can think of it kind of going all the way back to the beginning again and sort of just thinking about how magic specifically was an element of the earliest thoughts in the ghost cult, et cetera, going forward. But, it's even more of something that can be just sort of thought of as a concept. And, eventually even completely separated from being directly tied to a ghost or a quote-unquote spirit being of any sort. Okay. And, fetishes, charms, and magic is the name, and the word in the middle is just that. It's a concept that plays both ways. You can have fetish charms in a very direct sense, or you can have magical charms. Okay, just think of that contrast. He's obviously sounding like it's moving into more abstract notions. Okay, so and the other thing we need to remind ourselves of that we discovered as we were unpacking, especially right there towards the end in the totemism section. Remember how, as I was trying to explain what they were getting at there, it was very natural to start talking about science in the midst of all this discussion of evolutionary religion and seemingly very primitive issues. Nonetheless, you begin to see in the natural dynamic of these very superstitious people, a religion-science contrast building. I mean, after all, and I was saying that fetishism starts out maybe as kind of an augmentation of the ghost cult, I could have said, but it's more than just the science, quote-unquote, of the ghost cult. Right? I mean, just in any attempt to try to have this very rational description of exactly how this all is supposed to work, is a budding scientific mind. Right? I mean, it starts out as merely rational. But there's that urge in the fourth adjutant. Obviously, if a human is feeling a lot of urge from the sixth adjutant, the fourth adjutant is in play too. Yeah, not necessarily going to be in play in a balanced fashion with the sixth. But that so-called spirit of knowledge, right, the fourth adjutant, is there, and if nothing else, it's going to foster you wanting to have have things pinned down in a way that you feel like you know what's going on. You know, and the second adjunct, the spirit of understanding, you know, is going to get satisfied. It's like, I understand this. I know what's going on. Even if it's all, you know, superstitious, illusory rationalization, nonetheless, you're satisfying those urges to a degree. Okay. And, you know, when once we started bringing in something that we could start to call science in some primitive sense, we saw, remember, that we were immediately recognizing very definitive parallels to what's going on today with things like that evolutionary religion trying to reassert itself because, you know, approaching government as a scientific issue, which is, you know, what it technically is just too prosaic. We need to shove all of that science of the Constitution aside, for instance, and we need to get back to just, you know, the impassioned beliefs of an evolutionary religion about governmental affairs. And hence, it's not really going to be governmental affairs anymore, right? It's just going to be the machinations and whatnot of zealous religionists. So you'll see that was a long way to just point out that when we saw that naturally we found ourselves talking about the contrast between science and religion, you see they picked that up directly as we begin this next section. You know, and that's kind of the unexpected thing that you'll see that they point out immediately. As you start to read a discussion of what you're thinking is going to be far removed from science, all about magical notions, what's, you know, they're certainly not going to mention science anywhere in these sections. No, they're going to mention it in the first sentence. So let's, you got something first?
Yeah. Well, I just had a question that came up, and it has to do with fear. And I'm wondering, when did the idea that religion should somehow be a governor on our fear, when did that start? Because it seems like initially fear was just working full bore, and there was no conflict between the religious sense
and fear, right? That, fear. So for those of you on the webinar, if you couldn't hear that, he's wondering, you know, when did this sense of conflict between religion and fear come in? Hasn't religion always been thought about as being fundamentally based upon fear? Fear of the Lord and whatnot? Yeah, see, that's, we've studied, you know, and going through this, they've been pointing out how that is inescapably natural, you know, and the foundation for the beginning of what is quote-unquote called religion. So, I mean, just that, saying that, the only way there could possibly be some tension between fear and religion in human thought is because of revelation. A revelator must have said something like, fear not. Right? Like Jesus of Nazareth. Right? I mean, that's just reminding you of, I mean, obviously, Adam and Eve and the prince's staff for the first 300,000 years would have said things too. You know, Melchizedek would have said things. But, you know, whenever you think of something in our current religious environment that you know from the revelation, talking in detail about what's all the things that are natural, okay, and that wasn't one of them, or that's even directly in conflict with what they said was natural, you know, you see the vestiges of revelation from somewhere, somehow. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, and that's, of course, the kind of religion we have. It's a mixture of all the evolutionary things with a tiny little bit of revelatory tweaking thrown in. And it's very difficult for humans to hold on to any of that revelatory tweaking. You know, even you know, the internal recognition of truth, apart from you know, epical revelations and such things. I mean, just the internal recognition of truth that gets you to found a government on higher principles. That's going to be very tenuous. There's nothing natural about holding on to those things that you recognize through your insight. You're going to have to constantly reinforce against the natural tendency for that to evaporate and to go back to old forms of interaction amongst individuals and groups. So whether it's government or, you know, quote-unquote religion directly, whatever, you have this tenuous relationship to the revelation of truth on this planet, and it's very much slipping again to the point where there was an emergency declared and a fifth epical revelation was given, a revelation of truth, remember. Well, that's the whole point of revelation. Okay, so let's look at this issue how are they pointing out that, you know, we've talked an awful lot about how the beginnings of what eventually can be true religion has gotten spun up on this planet. How did the other half of the equation get spun up? Science. Let's see.
Section 4, magic. Civilized man attacks the problems of a real environment through his science. Savage man attempted to solve the real problems of an illusory ghost environment by magic. Magic was the technique of manipulating the conjectured spirit environment, whose machinations endlessly explained the inexplicable. It was the art of obtaining voluntary spirit cooperation and of coercing involuntary spirit aid through the use of fetishes or other and more powerful spirits.
Okay. Well, like I said, it's the very first sentence they mentioned science. So you inescapably have your engagement of the physical world, material world, and all of the issues that crop up. You have problems. You have real problems. Okay, it's this is a you know, the literal, objectively external world. Okay, real problems. Then the question is, how do you go about dealing with those real problems? Do you recognize physical causation and try to figure out the laws of it? Science. Or do you assume, as humans, you know, did for almost all of our million-year history, you know, and still want to do to a great degree, say, oh, I know what causes problems with the material world. It's the machinations of the spirits. Right? There's no such thing. You know, you don't reject it. You have no concept of it. Physical causation. Right? That's what you think the causation is. Spirits cause material doings. If matter's not doing anything, it's because spirit beings aren't doing anything with it. If matter's doing something, that's, you know that spirit beings are doing something with it, because it doesn't do anything on its own. Right? Very early on got the concept of inanimate. Right? So it's not doing anything on its own. Right? So you start with a very static concept of the physical world. You certainly don't start with the universe of motion theory, right? About the physical world, where you innately think of it as a, you know, as something that's doing, you know, just in its beingness, it's doing, you know, if you will. You think in very static terms, and you believe that anything that happens with it is the doings of spirit beings. Now, see, you can throw away the notion that it's the doings of spirit beings, you know, and like get really going with the three centuries of the Enlightenment. But did they change the initial assumption about matter that's really tied to the ghost explanation? No. They kept the assumption that matter is, you know, innately just, you know, a static fact. You know, and if it's doing anything, someone had to, you know, hit the pool ball with a pool cue or something, right? I mean, you had to kick the rock. The sun had to pull on the earth or something, right? See, so science is still laboring under the, you know, the sort of corollary consequences of rationalizing the doings of matter, you know, with that illusory ghost environment, right, that they just talked about. Yeah. And you know, so one of the things that the fifth epical revelation is doing, besides stressing that you should get rid of the ghost cult, is you need to start all over again on your science. You need a science that isn't predicated on the assumptions of the ghost cult. Okay? Assuming that it's innately a static fact.
Big Bang Theory is a religious notion, not a science.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. You know, we start talking about Big Bang Theory and things like that. I mean, you know, you'll see very quickly, you know, that is going to be in line with what they're saying. So I won't say anything right now about that.
Back to your question.
Oh yeah, okay.
Which was what do you do about your problems?
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people today pray to the master magician.
Yeah.
And expect the master magician to solve their problems for them magically. And I think, to be honest with you, you know, maybe that was one of the mistakes that came out of the biblical teaching of, you know, pray to God and get what you want. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people are turning away from religion today, because they aren't getting that.
Right.
The master magician is not solving their problems and changing their life.
Right.
So that transition that, you know, quite frankly, a lot of the religious world today is in that, you know, they're realizing they don't know how to cope with it. They don't know how to keep the religion and throw out the magic, so to speak.
Right. Because it's, you know, doesn't matter how fancy it's gotten, you know, and again, they're going to emphasize this in a second. It's still the case that you think that the whole point of God and praying to God is either obtaining voluntary spirit cooperation or coercing involuntary spirit aid. There hasn't been any other thought in religion. It doesn't matter what fancy words they use or what physics, quote unquote, they attach to it. You know, whether it's, you know, some you know, magical charm that does it, or prayer that does it, the same fundamental assumption is still there. That the whole point is to get spirit beings to play with matter in a way that you find pleasurable. All right, so it is still the illusory ghost environment. You know, now it's just the illusory God environment. But it's the same environment. And nothing has really changed. You just changed the names, but nothing has really changed. You know, and the real problems still are really not getting solved.
Yeah. Well, and they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater at the same time in terms of,
right,
God's not solving all the world's problems, and he can't.
Therefore, God doesn't exist, right? Because you've defined God as the person who solves material problems. Material problems aren't getting solved, therefore God doesn't exist. It's like, no. He started with a false initial assumption. God is not the being that solves material problems. Huh? Yeah.
Right. As a matter of fact, even Jesus said, you know, I'll go through your problems with you.
Not here to solve your problems, but I can help you. I can help you have spiritual strength during your material problems.
And oh, by the way, I'm going to give you more problems.
Yeah.
Well, that, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, again, and what does the fifth epical revelation say? So that whole spirit help thing, let's assume you actually got it from an angel or from an adjuster. Does it make life more pleasant? No. You don't want, you know, actually, you really don't know what you're asking for. You know, for them to cross that divide and really play around with matter is not going to be for your pleasure.
Right.
Right? There's going to be some bigger picture in play, you know, and, you know, you might find that it gets really prickly for you in addressing some big picture. So, yeah, because if they're engaging matter, it's apart from you as a, you know, your spiritual nature. It's engaging matter, you know, and in the realm of matter, you're just a blob of matter that doesn't matter.
Yeah, very good.
Okay, they'll just build the super highway right over the top of you, right? In that mode, and so,
Chris?
Yep.
It's hard to hold that perspective in your head, and I, you know, I think that's true, and that's the case, and also at the same time understand that. You know, there's, I don't know, one facet of God that looks at just you at the same time.
Yeah. He loves the part of you that doesn't relate directly to the material world. That's the part of you he loves. Right? The part of you that can be strong no matter what's happening to the physical you. He loves that part. He's no relationship to the other part, the part that's having the problem with matter. Now, can your spiritual nature really have a problem with matter? No, spirit and matter are absolutely separate. You know, the degree to which you think matter is affecting you spiritually is the degree to which you're using your free will in an unfortunate way to make your spiritual nature a mere reflection of the physical world. Right? And hence, you're surrendering your free will. You're using your free will to surrender your free will and become a helpless victim of the antecedent causation of a physical environment. Jesus said, you know, I'm here to try to help you to know that you can stand apart. I'm not going to change the fact that you're going to suffer, but I can help you to hold on to that aspect of you that's in you by grace that really shouldn't be affected by matter. It only is to the degree which you unfortunately choose to make it a helpless victim of matter. It isn't innately that way. It's only that way in your unfortunate hands. Stop doing that. Doctor, it hurts when I do this. Jesus said, well, stop doing it. Right? The teacher, the doctor, teacher, the master said, stop doing it. Right? And, you know, that's what... So, you know, it's important to go, like, you know, even stressing, why are we going through all this history about fetishes, charms, and magic? It's, again, to remind us of how there's some unfortunate assumptions that we've attached to quote-unquote spiritual affairs that really aren't, see, doesn't make them so they aren't really spiritual affairs now. They're illusions attached to material affairs. Now, obviously, the illusions attached to material affairs are really bound up in material affairs because you've chosen to make them bound. But your genuine spiritual nature is absolutely separate at its foundation from all things physical. And it can stand unmoved when earthly things crash.
earthly things aren't all bad, though. I mean, they're a great little tether to keep us from getting a little zingy.
But of course, you know, that's a whole issue of, you know, you can say, hey, earthly things aren't all bad. It's like, well, okay, what's the definition of bad?
Yeah.
You know, mostly what we mean is earthly things aren't all unpleasant. The tricky thing is many things that are physically unpleasant are spiritually good. And many things, you know, that are physically pleasant are spiritually bad. Mm-hmm. You know, like Jesus said, random acts of kindness, which are materially pleasant and we think are hence good, and that's why we're doing them, because he told us to go about doing good. You know, he says, no, those are really bad. You know, he says that point blank. You know, you think your desire is to go about doing good, but random acts of kindness, indiscriminate acts of kindness, actually produce evil, not good.
How so?
We don't need to go off on that. You know, just
it doesn't mean you don't be kind.
It doesn't mean you don't be kind. It's just you need to be discriminating. You see, you know, read the paragraph that follows that opening sentence. You know, find it in the Jesus papers. He explains, right? You know, and there's many other, you know, we've already read, you know, several things, and we'll read more about that. You know, the negative consequences, the evil consequences of unfortunate assumptions about what's good.
Remember, you said, I'm not going to counsel you on your earthly problems, but I will counsel you on your problems with your relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a different.
And of course, you remember, he's very much in that mode. He's just addressing the inner life. The fifth epical revelation is different. It's trying to help us with all things outer life. You know, Jesus' mission was to let the outer life issues basically be what they were. He occasionally said some things in private to the apostles and whatnot. But in general, he didn't go there. Right? The fifth epical revelation goes everywhere there. You know, it's here to blow up every cherished thought we have about everything in our outer life. You know, so it's definitely not for someone who's, just a timid soul who's needing that little bit of strengthening of an inner life to deal with their outer life problems. You know, they're not looking for, and you certainly shouldn't try to give them what the fifth epical revelation is offering. It just, you know, blows up all of the illusions, you know, that give people, you know, a basic ability to get up in the morning. Right. If prayer isn't about, what they're talking about here, obtaining voluntary spirit cooperation, for example. I mean, they're probably going to completely despair, probably commit suicide.
But it does talk a lot about inner life, contacting with your adjuster.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, you can't talk about the real outer life if you don't talk about the real inner life. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, the fifth epical revelation talks about both, but it's very interesting to note that, you know, Jesus was bounded away from the outer life issues, right? And he wouldn't let them drag him there.
Well, he knew where the fish were.
Okay.
He had to put up with that.
Yes. It's not that he didn't have lots of material pragmatism. Remember, he went all the way to First Circler. You don't get to First Circler without a balanced cosmic consciousness. Okay. Anyway, back to the material here. So you've got the exact same desire to solve your material problems is behind the notion of magic as what's behind the notion of science. See, so they're very, very much related. You know, and you can just guess, oh, I bet you at some point they're going to say magic, you know, evolved into science. Yeah, of course it did, see. That's how science got started, is, you know, and that's why I've been saying it a number of times, you know, there's a physics, quote-unquote, or a science, quote-unquote, to you know, this whole illusory ghost environment. They have specific notions about this does this and that does that, and right, it's not this does whatever or that does whatever. It's precise. It's, you know, it's attempting to think causally and factually. It doesn't matter if they didn't succeed, right? It was an attempt to. They didn't think it was an illusory ghost environment. They thought it was a fact. They thought they were dealing with the science of those facts, which are the important facts. They're the causal facts. What's the point of staring at the wood of this table? There's no causal facts there, right? Look to the causal facts, the illusory ghost environment, right? So science is figuring out the details of the facts. That's what they were doing. They were trying to figure out the details of the facts as they understood them, as they conceived them.
Yeah, and 50% of the time they were right, just because it was kind of random.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes a shaman got it right.
Yes.
The object of magic, sorcery, and necromancy was twofold. One, to secure insight into the future. Two, favorably to influence environment.
Okay, so just let's see that simple little statement, just to point out that there's this twofold. A lot of times when people think about, say, necromancy, in other words, divination of the dead, right, they only think of number one. I'm only trying to contact the dead in some way because I want the dead to tell me, because they know, about the future. It wasn't all the future thing. There was two sides to it. Sometimes it was just about your immediate circumstances, just like prayer is not always about the future. Sometimes, it's about your immediate circumstances, like a better parking space. Yeah. And when you find it, you know that your prayer has been answered. The same way that when, they found it in the old days, they knew that the magic worked. Yeah. Because they believed, as we still believe, confirmations are proof. You can confirm false theories. They don't mean anything. Right? All right. And then the other little thing is, when they say magic and sorcery, why two of them? I mean, basically what you mean there is, the first one is white magic, and the second one, sorcery, is black magic. Right? Magic is, just magic is white magic. Sorcery is, that's black magic. And obviously that sort of a notion is going to get all the more strengthened once you have dual spiritism, evolving in the ghost cult. That there would be two flavors of magic. Because there's two flavors of spirits that you're either trying to get the cooperation of, or are trying to coerce.
Okay. Obtain or coerce.
All right.
The objects of science are identical with those of magic. Mankind is progressing from magic to science, not by meditation and reason, but rather through long experience, gradually and painfully. Man is gradually backing into the truth, beginning in error, progressing in error, and finally attaining the threshold of truth. Only with the arrival of the scientific method has he faced forward. But primitive man had to experiment or perish.
Okay, let me do the aside first. Let's do the second half of the paragraph first. So, man is gradually backing into the truth, beginning in error, progressing in error, and finally attaining the threshold of truth. It is impossible for you to do anything but that when you pick up and start reading the fifth epical revelation. You've got to know that. It's going to take you a long time to even get to the threshold of truth. Right, you're backing into the truth. You're going to begin in error, 100%. Every initial interpretation that you make of the Urantia book is erroneous. Just assume that. It does no harm, even if it isn't 100% valid. You know, maybe revelation in the past is helping you a little bit to not be totally off base. But don't assume that. It's best to assume that 100% everything you interpret is erroneous, so that you don't fall in love with yourself and your interpretations. Start with the humility of, I'm 100% erroneous. Right? That's what a child of God basically is, right? But for that tiny little thread of grace, right? The rest of it, I mean, before you have any relationship to truth, could you possibly be in truth? No. To begin with, a child of God is an erroneous phenomenon, not a truthful phenomenon.
Actually, you drew close to the truth by assuming 100% error.
Yes. Right, see? Right, you, like I said, you're on the threshold of truth when you take that initial assumption that every interpretation is erroneous to begin with. Right? So it's going to begin in error, and it's going to progress in error. It's like, well, how could it progress in error? Well, because we progress in spite of ourselves, remember? Right? Even though, you know, 10 years later, you're still reading, and it's and technically all of your interpretations are still erroneous. Right? There's a progression that's going on superconsciously.
That's why it appears new.
Right? And it's possible that if you stay humble, you know, assuming that you aren't all over it right to begin with, right? If you stay humble, instead of that 10 years going on likewise to 50, right? After 10 years, some things will start to dawn in your conscious mind, right? Because superconsciously you've been progressing in spite of yourself, right? And it will finally reach a level of integrity that it sort of begins to take a hold of the framework of your mind, and all of a sudden your eyes are opened and you start to see things very differently, not so erroneously. But you're not going to get there if you say, well, I'm innately divine, and every, you know, first time I'm reading it, it's nothing but truth. Okay? So someone who is using their free will like that can't be progressed in spite of themselves. And that's why even after 50 years, nothing's changed. Because mm-hmm. they've willed it to not change. Because they believe that they don't need to be changed. Their political thoughts are perfect. Their economic thoughts are perfect. Their thoughts about angels are perfect. Whatever. Okay, so, you know, the easiest way to really bring that second half of that paragraph to a point is think about your relationship to this book. And then notice what else is it? Only with the arrival of the scientific method has he faced forward. And you've heard me talk about that a million times, right? And that's the genuine scientific method, not what's called the scientific method now, you know, which is the data collection and analysis method. That's not the scientific method, because that doesn't get you any closer to the truth than no data collection and analysis. That's just, you know, gathering information and playing with it. The scientific method is fundamentally a method designed to get you to truth. Right? It's a method where you know that there's an infinite number of false theories that you can generate to rationalize the data that you collected and analyzed. Okay, how do you get to the one true theory out of a haystack pile of an infinite number of false ones? How do you do that? Well, you're obviously not going to get to it in any sort of quick fiat way. You're going to have to kind of back into it, the scientific, the genuine scientific method says, right? It, you attempt to refute the theory, right? And by refute, you know, the re prefix is important. You're trying to take it back to the logical framework and invalidate it. And you work, you know, if it's your theory, you work and you work and you work to try to refute it. And you can't seem to find any logical, reasonable refutation. So you publish it. And you ask everyone who reads that article to join in the effort to try to refute this theory. You know, and after hundreds of years and millions of people trying to refute it and no one being able to find a logical or reasonable refutation, you can always find a rational argument to reject it because you can rationalize anything. Okay? Again, you know, so it's not refutation is not just, well, here's a counter-rationalization. No, that doesn't mean anything. And you're trying to refute, not merely confute. And you know, if no one can find any way to refute this, well, then you go, maybe, just maybe, having backed into it like this, maybe we're on the threshold of truth. That's the scientific method. It's just what they described. That's the real scientific method. That's nowhere to be found anymore. They collect data, they analyze it, they find a confirmation, they've proved it, and then they go from there. That's what they do now.
Pass out awards and publish.
Right. And, but see, what they're trying to talk about is, you know, and if you don't take that genuine scientific method, and it doesn't matter if you're talking about God or atoms, it doesn't matter what you're talking about, if you don't approach it with the scientific method, the genuine scientific method, you're never going to get facing forward. It's only with the arrival. Only way to be a true seeker and to eventually face forward, you know, and then be able to use the spirit of truth. Because, see, until you're facing forward, you can't use the spirit of truth. It's just sitting there twiddling its thumbs. Now, if you, you know, the only way to do that is to be in that refutation mode. Try to refute your beliefs about angels, your beliefs about God. Oh, no, they're sacred. That would be sacrilege to attempt to refute them. Okay, I can't help you then. You have to have the courage to take on your beliefs. Right? And until you're attempting to refute them, you're not a truth seeker. Doesn't matter how many times you say you are. Yeah. You know, it's just saying it doesn't make it so. Well, we've always believed that words are magical. Yeah, well, we're about to read about that too. Okay, saying you're a truth seeker is not a magical incantation that makes you a truth seeker.
Okay. Did you do it in Latin?
Yeah, even when you do it in Latin, it doesn't make Veritas, Veritas, Veritas. No. Okay, so you can see how unexpected this, you know, discussion about magic starts out. All right. Okay, now the first part. See, the objects of science are identical with those of magic, like I said.
Yeah.
Right? It's the exact same real physical, you know, issue out there. You know, the magician and the scientist are looking at the exact same objects for the exact same reasons. Why do you make my life unpleasant? You ask the object, right? What can I do so it isn't like that? So, you know, it's just that they have very different approaches of how to go about that. Or at least they used to. Right. You all know that this is... See, magic, science just had, it just barely pulled itself out of magic. So how much would it take to slip back in? Not much. Right? And it did it just like that. Right? It lasted about 30 years before it went right back. And now all the assumptions of science are magical again. So it isn't really science again. It's, you know, it's a whole illusory environment again. Right? Science is predicated on all sorts of so-called facts that aren't facts. And we rationalize everything based upon those illusions. You know, like the nucleus of an atom is made out of quarks. Quarks don't exist any more than the ghosts did. Right? You know, or you rationalize that picture you just took at the center of M87 as a supermassive black hole. Yeah. Supermassive black holes don't exist any more than ghosts existed. That's an illusory environment. Those are magical objects, just like ghosts were.
And, you yeah. have enough experience with facing forward to have ever gotten acquainted, really, with it.
Yeah.
Well, they are doing some work on the genome, which is kind of interesting.
Right, there's a lot of data, you know, that needs to be collected yet. It's, I mean, see, and again, don't... See, that there's a lot of that genome and stuff. See, that's really this technology, really. It's not science. There's lots of information that we're gathering, but we still don't know anything about this. I mean, does anyone know that that our DNA is mostly a structure that mind attunes to?
No.
You know, and that the physical doings are secondary? No. See, do they really know anything about DNA? No.
Well, they just started.
We have lots of information about DNA. But
well, just started, basically.
Yeah, but again, we'll never get out of where we are. It doesn't matter how much more fancy we get about playing with DNA, how many things we can fix and whatnot, it's still, we still won't know anything because our assumptions about what we're dealing with is... are not real. See, you can make lots and lots of progress with all kinds of false assumptions. But see, genuine science, the scientific method, is about figuring out truthfully what's, you know, what's DNA. Right? You know, another way to talk about it, it's all that data collection and analysis and all the benefits that can have for, you know, what causes cancer and how to fix cancer and all that. Okay, again, that's not technically what we're talking about when we're talking about science. Okay, that's just physical information and how to deal with it. Science is something deeper than that. Because it's something deeper than just that superficial stuff, that's why science, genuine science, can combine with genuine religion. If science was just that superficial stuff, like exactly, you know, what things do I need to change in the chromosome to cure cancer, if that's all science was, it wouldn't have an interface with religion. So there couldn't be a super additive consequence.
It sounds like you're saying magic can cure disease.
It can. It cured diseases for hundreds of thousands of years. If you believe that something that the shaman does will cure you, you're cured. I mean, the people...
Jesus says your faith is...
Jesus could just be there in the camp, right. And the people believed that because he was there, he didn't have to do anything. They believed they were healed just because they were co-located with him. And they were genuinely healed.
Then what about the healing at sundown when there was all kinds of beings?
Well, okay, there's other times when he's doing something. Okay. But we're not talking about that,
okay.
Right? I mean, we're just talking about,
distinguish.
You know, and we'll talk about this an awful lot, right? I mean, this is a very important thing about, I mean, you know, they're going to mention it too. I mean, magic appears to work just like black hole physics appears to work. Right? You calculate everything, you measure it. It's like the calculations exactly match the measurements. This is a true theory, you say. It appears to work, right? You know, if you believe, I mean, remember, mind dominates matter. If you believe something fixes you, it's not impossible that it won't fix you. I mean,
that's backing in.
Everyone knows there's a thing called the placebo effect. Right. Do you think that's magic? Or do you think that's physics?
Physics.
Right? I mean, the way people talk about it, you know, it sounds like they're trying to just, oh, that's that old magic stuff. No, we're scientists. No, that person is, you know, was just as effectively cured as the pill you gave to some people. Right? The molecules got rearranged in both cases. In one case, molecules rearranged molecules. In the other case, mind rearranged molecules. And like I've said so many times, it's much easier to rearrange molecules with mind than it is with matter. Right? Again, I use my simple example. I'm moving my hand in front of my face. Which pill in my medicine cabinet do I take to make my hand move like this? Well, none of them. Well, but yeah, but there's some really psychoactive drugs. We could probably fine-tune one that'd kind of get you to flail around. Yeah, but no, I'm moving it very precisely, and now I'm putting these two fingers together, and I'm rotating it 30 degrees, and then I'm lowering it 4 inches. Okay, which pill does that?
It doesn't say in the book things like, you know, yep. Mind doesn't bend spoons type thing?
I'm just curious. I mean, my mind doesn't have a hold of this table. It doesn't have a hold of all matter, but it has a very special hold on the matter of my body. I mean, after all, again, if you were here last week and I held up my hand like I'm doing right now, did it look kind of like it looks right now? Probably pretty similar. Why? Does physical causality laws make my hand stay shaped the same from week to week?
Well, no, you didn't get a manicure.
No, there's nothing. There's nothing in those physical laws that make my hand stay the same. Right? Mind is keeping it the same. Mind is using the physical causality to keep my hand shaped like this.
Mechanical mind or mind?
Almost immediately, it's mechanical mind, right? But I mean, see, again, it's very important, you know, to understand this. I mean, we kind of got off on a tangent, but let's try to pin this down because we're going to be talking about it a lot as we go forward. I mean, this is very important. Right? At least think of yourself as mind and body. Right? Not just body. Like the scientists today do. Right? You go to the doctor, he thinks you're just matter. Okay? He's ignoring the dominant energy of your nature. Right? You have physical energy, and he's acknowledging that, but you also have mind energy, and he's ignoring that. He's dismissing that, and mind dominates matter. Right? Like I said, after all, if mind stopped being engaged to this matter, my hand, 3 days later, my hand's just coming apart.
Yeah.
Right? There's nothing in the matter itself that maintains that.
Gravity, nothing.
Nothing. Definitely not gravity. Yeah, you got to get something really, really big before gravity is important. Okay.
So, Chris, how does it get maintained in you know, an infant with very little. Well, I guess its mind still is different.
Again, I mean,
it's what? Not necessarily thinking mind.
Mind energy is holding together the single-celled conception in its form.
I see.
I mean, again, if there's any order, what does the Urantia book say about this? If you go anywhere in the universe and find order, that proves that there's mind. Because matter doesn't self-order. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. You know, if you go to a big scale and you notice some sort of grand ordering, like there's, you know, four outer space levels or things like that. Matter doesn't just organize itself like that.
Nothing made it do things.
Mind made. Right. Is that why you don't exist?
Mind planned, mind made, and mind administered.
Is that why you don't exist if you went outside of Nebulon? Because your mind wouldn't be there?
Well, I mean, you know, you're
not now, but I mean,
if I, you know, got on the Starship Enterprise and went sailing outside of the boundaries of Nevenon, my body would still be on the Enterprise, but my mind would come unplugged. Okay.
So does your body then exist without your mind? Yes.
Well, I mean, the matter, the, you know, exists, but it's not going to hold its form. See, the mind doesn't control the matter directly. The mind superimposes a form upon the matter, and then the matter conforms with that form. Aristotle knew this. Scientists don't believe that anymore. Because, there's... Again, like I was saying, I mean, it's not that the mind is, you know, grabbing a hold of and is a physical energy that's manipulating the matter in my fingers. Right? You can study the matter in my fingers, and all the matter itself explains what's going on. You know, in the microscopic, you know, functioning of the details. But the big question is, yeah, okay, yes, but why is it shaped like a finger? You know, and your answer would, well, because DNA dictates it. Okay, so you're saying, you know this, I give this example all the time. So I can buy an empty lot, I can bring in a semi-load of lumber, plop it on the empty lot, you know, set a few kegs of nails, you know, next to the lumber, put a hammer on one of the kegs of nails, and I can drape the blueprint over the top of the whole pile, and I can step back off the lot, and it just builds itself. It's got the blueprint. It's got the DNA. No, you go, no. Just because it has the pattern doesn't mean that it's going to build itself. Yeah. So, yeah, why do my fingers get built? It isn't because I have DNA. That just explains why they're shaped the way they are. Why did they get shaped like they are? Who built the? What phenomenon, what influence built it? Okay. Mind is the builder of your body. It's what holds it together, maintains it.
And take is there the, personality take, behind all that mind?
Well, again, see, you know, we can go beyond body and mind and bring in spirit and personality and all this sort of stuff. That just adds to the complexity of the situation. Okay. But, you know, you're not going to get anywhere if you don't at least bring in mind. You don't have to bring in any details. Is it mechanical mind? Is it agitated mind? Okay, just forget about all the details. Right? Just think in simple terms. There has to be a mind and a body, and mind has to be dominant over matter. Otherwise, what I'm observing is illogical. Right? There has to be two energies, and the energy I can't see has to be dominant over the energy I see. Because the energy I see is doing things that it doesn't do by itself.
And you may or may not have control over that.
I mean, doesn't it talk to you about, doesn't the book mention, you know, about, you know, you can't, by thought or by wishing, you can't increase your height by a cubit or whatever.
Right.
You can't just do. But.
Right. And see, now, and your mind is, you know, there's certain laws of mind energy. Those can't be changed. They just are what they are. You know, just like the laws of matter can't be changed. They are what they are. You know, there's certain boundary conditions put on the mind energy that's directly attuned to your body, engaged to your body. And so it just does what it's allowed to do with its laws and its boundary conditions. See, and the only way out of that is if you add something on top of mind. Right? Personality can take a hold of spirit energy. And spirit energy dominates mind energy. Right? And so from above, I can put a different form on my mind than the form it has naturally, the boundary condition it has naturally. Right? I can change the form. I can change the finger shape of a form of my mind, right? And that can work down. If I change the form within which my mind functions, that's going to change the way mind engages the body, right? Your free will is not in mind over matter, right? It just is fixed. Your free will is in spirit over mind.
Which is way cooler than just making yourself a little taller.
And when all is said and done, that's the only thing that's important, because your body's not going anywhere. It's going into the hole in the ground or in a fireplace or something.
Yeah.
Okay? Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Right? It's, you know, the part that we're ignoring is the only part that's worth really being concerned about. It's your mind, you know, basically that's resurrected. Your mind or self that's resurrected, not your body. So if you want to be concerned about form, don't be so concerned about the form of your body. Be concerned about the form of your mind, because it's the forms in your mind that are resurrected, not the forms of your body. You spend all your life working on getting a certain form in your body, and the universe could care less. You die and it all just unravels, and none of that work is carried forward to the next life. But the work you do in changing the forms of your mind, that's respected and resurrected. That's something worth putting some effort into.
Survival value.
Yeah.
So just think about how productive it would be if we really understood what the various factors actually are, and were able to understand their real relationships and the real physics and the real, you know, the real formulas, and be able to leverage that stuff. Just think about what kind of shining science we could have then.
Right. The reason
that's cool.
The reason you want to figure out how to change your DNA is not because you want to change the form of your body. You want to change your DNA so that the natural form around your mind is different. It's a better starting point than the one you've got right now. So you don't have to use so much spirit over mind to morph things into a better state.
Is that what Adam and Eve are supposed to do?
Yes, Adam and Eve are supposed to get it. So your the natural form of your mind, because mind is attuned to the genetics, you know, is in a much better starting place. You know, like the seventh adjutant, it doesn't have so many sharp edges that it's grinding against, and hence can't really move. Right? It's in a symmetric space, and so the energy of symmetry can fully flow without any friction. Right? But right now, we're not that way, because we didn't get much uplift.
Cross currents.
Right, all this stuff, all these cross currents and whatnot. Yeah, but even with a full, just because you have a full genetic uplift and all the races are blended into one race and everything. When you have a race like that, a single uplifted race like that, are children born first circlers?
No.
No. They're still born seven circlers. Yeah, they're not even born seven circlers, you know. I mean, yeah, they eventually become a seven circler, right, at roughly age six. I mean, you still have to do all that work of going up those cosmic levels. Right, that's you changing the form of your mind from above, using spirit over mind to change the form of your mind from what it started as. Obviously, if your mind is in a better initial form, there's going to be a more beautiful body. Adamic children have beautiful bodies. But that's not because the whole point was to make beautiful bodies. They have beautiful minds. And a beautiful body comes along for the ride with a beautiful mind.
So that's probably more like when they say in the mansion rules, you look on the outside more like who you are on the inside.
Yeah, right? See, once your body is Morancha substance, which you can kind of think of as mind-made substance, right, it's obviously going to be, your body is going to be much more immediately expressive of the mind forms. You know, right now, there's a lot of difference between a mind form and a body form. There won't be as much difference right now. Won't be as much difference then as there is now. Because it's just closer together naturally. Okay. Wow.
Maybe not many beauty pageants going on up there. there's no competition. Everybody's pretty...
We might get through this chapter.
Yeah, I don't know here. This is going a lot slower than I thought it was going to. Okay. That's fine. It's not a race. So let's go back to that paragraph and just, get ourselves planned. So mankind is progressing from magic to science, not by meditation and reason, but rather through long experience, gradually and painfully. Okay. Because we're backing into it, right? That's why it's gradually and painfully. Okay, but you notice there's a meditation and reason. The reason part seems appropriate because we're talking about science here so much. You know, science and reason is the validation mechanism of genuine science. Meditation. What on earth does the contemplation of sacred matters have to do with this? Nothing. Oh, I'm not using the proper definition of meditation, am I?
Guess not.
Yeah. Very important, okay? There, when you see the word meditation, you put that in an old mystical wineskin. So the Revelation is not talking about the so-called contemplation of sacred matters, as a devotional, method. It's not what we're talking about, okay? Meditation, okay, the literal root there is measure. Not by measured thought and reason. That's what that means. Yeah. So reason is where you've got that rational line that you're chugging down, but it starts with a reasonable initial assumption, reasonable based upon your first cosmic intuition. And it's based on fact and causality, and off you go along that line of reasoning. And upon that foundation, you've got something a little bit more holistic. Measured thought. let's see, what adjutant would have to do with measured thought? I wonder if it's the energy of symmetry, the energy of balance and proportion.
Good.
The seventh adjutant, right, that says, well, on the one hand I've got this, and on the other hand I've got this. Right, see, that's measured thought. Right, you're weighing things against each other, right? Right, you've got that basic philosophic impulse of the seventh adjutant, that is there in a rudimentary fashion too. Nothing. See, we're not talking about anything too grandiose here, but just these very foundational things of, we're not even talking about reflective thinking. See, we're just talking about genuine meditation. Bringing in that little bit of holistic objectivity that seventh adjutant can bring into play. Just, kind of a rough fashion. See, and that other notion that, people who fancy mysticism, are interested in, that they call meditation. There's the reason why that's called meditation is you are... you're not getting fully up. You may call it contemplation, but you aren't really kind of fully up in the temple, up in the upper domain. You're in the neck. Remember, the seventh adjutant on the third level of meaning is in the neck. So it's kind of sort of in the temple, it's at the threshold anyway, right? It's kind of quasi-reflection to be there. But the thing is, it's like, okay, how would I, quote-unquote, contemplate sacred matters for devotional purposes or whatever you want to say, that sort of definition of meditation. I would need to get a little bit up of where I have the sense of sacred matters. I need to get a little bit above the sixth adjutant. Yeah, go up to the seventh, right? And it's they're not really using the seventh adjutant for what it is, but they're standing on it in order to look down and quote-unquote contemplate the sacred matters that the sixth adjutant has dreamt up. Okay? And be devotional, right, in that observation. Okay, but we're not talking about such a a passive state of affairs here. We're talking something more active, really using the seventh adjutant to add a little bit of objectivity and wholeness to just a mere line of reasoning. And the two together can obviously get you up into a full, more reflective mode, fully in the upper domain, bringing in a full, holistic, logical perspective. Okay. But
the business practice, mm-hmm, that's being advocated these days of mindfulness,
mm-hmm,
sounds a lot like the actual definition of meditation here.
Yeah, measured thought.
Measured thought. I mean, basically, being in a space, a mental space,
mm-hmm,
where you're objectively taking things in and not judging them, just very hands off, just what is,
mm-hmm,
so that you're not, ruling in or out or whatever, just
right.
what is,
right.
And losing all the other thoughts in your head at the time.
Yeah, that's what the seventh adjutant gives you. As the energy of symmetry. That's what that's how you can do that.
Cool.
Quote unquote, that kind of quote unquote mindfulness. Yeah. That's the seventh adjutant, and kind of just its basic, fanciest of animal mode. Right? You're not using it fully as a spirit of wisdom yet, right? Okay. But see, you're at least beginning to stand there and benefit a little bit from its innate greater objectivity. I mean, at the very least, it's a higher vantage point, see? if nothing else. So, yeah, that's what they're getting at there. So anyway, I mean, that seems like a lot to bring that out, but it's when they present an opportunity like this, it needs to be taken to really start to pin some of this down so that you don't continue to live in a space where every time they mention meditation, you're often mystical, Middle Ages stuff. Okay? Because you're going to miss the point. Okay. Maybe before I go on, everyone should understand that those initial mystical thoughts, is like they're going to talk about with magic, they have their place and their benefits in helping you to progress in spite of yourself.
Thank God.
They're not evil. They're not bad. Right? they're not an abomination, in some real sense. Okay. But they are so limited, right? And you want to try to mature out of those child spaces. Okay, let's get a little bit more here.
The fascination of early superstition was the mother of the later scientific curiosity. There was progressive, dynamic emotion, fear plus curiosity, in these primitive superstitions. There was progressive driving power in the olden magic. These superstitions represented the emergence of the human desire to know and to control planetary environment.
See, the desire to know, right? The spirit of knowledge. Like I said, to get the fourth adjutant getting in there a little bit more. And then eventually having, not just the urges of the fourth adjutant, but genuine knowingness predicated on our reflective objectivity. But let's see, they're pointing out that without magic, the ghost cult would have been a very limited phenomenon. Magic actually makes it more useful longer, because it's unwittingly getting the fourth adjutant in play a little bit with the sixth. So there's some balance there between individuality and unity. And okay, if you get a little bit more balance, there's more potential to go up. Right? Just even if you don't really know anything, just having the desire to know. Right? The sixth adjutant doesn't give you a desire to know. The fourth adjutant does. It's that scientific impulse, in contrast to the sixth being a religious impulse. Okay. Now, look at that fascinating thing at the beginning. Pardon the pun. Fascinating thing. Yeah, the fascination of early superstition was the mother of the later scientific curiosity. Well, why didn't they say the father? Isn't that what they meant? Didn't they mean it's the father? No, they don't. See, here's where you need to really think about what we always say about the basic sense of the difference between using father and mother. If they said father, they would be saying the fascination of early superstition was the initiator, that would be the father, of the later scientific curiosity. No, that's not what they're saying. It wasn't the initiator, it was the mother. Well, what does that mean? So not initiator, it means womb, focalizer, upholder. See, that fascination of early superstition, see, that was the womb and the focalizer and the upholder of the later scientific curiosity. It's the womb in which that grows, right? It focalizer, look at what they said. There was progressive dynamic emotion, fear plus curiosity. Ah, fear. Focalizer, right? Right, that focus, you know, set the emotional consequences of that fear energy aside, right? Just think about the fact that's there, that focus. Right? Focalizer, mother, and upholder, the maintainer. That's what they're getting at. Look how sophisticated a use that is, eh? Mm-hmm. And if you can't remember that, you know, just, you know, go to the library and get that little thing about the contrast between father and mother that I, you know, wrote on that one sheet that, you know, that's in there. Okay, progressive, dynamic, progressive, right? You're progressing in spite of yourself. Because you have these useful forms that are there in the mind. So there was progressive driving power in the olden magic. Okay, so it gets the ball rolling so that eventually you can have, you know, science begin in the 6th century BC with the ancient Greeks, and it can come to a reasonable flower, you know, as a beginning, you know, during the 3 centuries in the Enlightenment. 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. Okay, let's keep going.
Magic gained such a strong hold upon the savage because he could not grasp the concept of natural death. The later idea of original sin helped much to weaken the grip of magic on the race in that it accounted for natural death. It was at one time not at all uncommon for 10 innocent persons to be put to death because of supposed responsibility for one natural death. This is one reason why ancient peoples did not increase faster, and it is still true of some African tribes. The accused individual usually confessed guilt even when facing death.
Let's just start with that last...
That's interesting.
That last point, see? Again, how soberly, seriously, factually, they think all this is. And the accused individual usually confessed guilt. I mean, it was obvious to him. Yeah, I agree with you completely. I must have been responsible for that death. I see the rational point you're making. Right, because there's some rationalization. And you go, well, I can't argue with that. That conforms with our physics, our science, right? So this is all taken very factually and soberly. So it wasn't just because tribes were constantly warring and killing each other. There's this, I guess this is one reason.
That's quite a reason.
Yeah, it's like 10 for 1. So it's going to be difficult to get a geometric population increase going here.
I'll get rid of your population problem.
Yeah. Jamie, you know, we could bring back that old time religion, you know, if anyone is worried about overpopulation. But again, notice the other thing about. But how all this stuff has its place. You know, we can belittle the notion of original sin. Okay, but, I mean, it was super important when they dreamt up that scheme to help move us away from magic. Right? At least in this big driving area about the mystery of natural death. Okay. I mean, so you stopped killing 10 people. See, that was a great... All you had to do is invent an original sin, and ta-da, those 10 people don't have to die. Well, that was worth it. So it has some negative consequences as it rolls forward. All good things taken to a stream become bad. But, hey, it's a good
kind
thing.
Like slavery versus killing the enemy.
Right, yeah, right. slavery in contrast to cannibalism, you know, whatever, right? And all these things have their place in the in an evolutionary process. So as you notice, they're pointing that out. It helped much to weaken the grip of magic. Let's see. You know, again, we talked about that. Remember how that was one of the things that really got all this stuff started? It's just there was no notion that that death was natural. That it could be natural. And again, you know, we just were, you know, a while back, I was reminding you of why that is. It's like, why couldn't they wrap their mind around that concept? Because again, if matter changes, it's because some spirit influence changed it. Death is a change, right? It can't be something internal behind it. No, it has to be an external influence. That's their assumption. So there's just no way to recognize that death can be natural. You've assumed it away. There's none so blind as those who will not see. All right. Anything else there? Yeah, I think we got it all there. Here, keep going.
Magic is natural to a savage. He believes that an enemy can actually be killed by practicing sorcery on his shingled hair or fingernail trimmings. The fatality of snake bites was attributed to the magic of the sorcerer. The difficulty in combating magic arises from the fact that fear can kill. Primitive peoples so feared magic that it did actually kill, and such results were sufficient to substantiate this erroneous belief. In case of failure, there was always some plausible explanation. A cure for defective magic was more magic.
See, and this is exactly, like I keep saying, where science, so-called science is again. Exactly.
Cure for bad science is more science.
Right. For a bad rationalization is yet another magical rationalization, right? Okay. That whole bit, you know, the key thing is, and such results were sufficient to substantiate this erroneous belief. Why? Because they assumed that confirmations meant something. I did this woo-woo thing. He died. What more proof do you need?
A causal link.
But you're looking for a physical causal link. They have a causal link.
Any kind of
machinations of spirit beings, right? That's what they know is the cause. There is no such thing as physical causality. See, but they have the encirclement of the Holy Spirit. They have the first cosmic intuition. They know there has to be causality. It's just that they have interesting assumptions about causality.
A true causality.
Yeah. See, it's a false causality, but it's causality. And of course, the scientific method is trying to figure out true causality. You can rationalize anything. You can always come up with a quote, an apparent cause, in an illusory environment.
It was formative when these folks practiced it, but for us to be falling back into it, an emergency.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, the cure for defective magic was more magic. It's beyond question that the nucleus of an atom is made out of protons and neutrons, we assume. Oh, but protons repel each other so they wouldn't stay together. Oh, well, we've discovered the strong force that holds those little billiard balls together. And the cure for defective magic was more magic. Okay. This is what we've been doing for over 100 years now in so-called science. Is this same silly thing where you just add another, rationalization to it? It's like, well, that kind of magic, that doesn't work on Tuesdays. you know, that was Wednesday. On Wednesdays, you know, there's a different ritual that you have to do. And, whatever. You know, you can dream up a rationalization.
Yeah, it seems like the problem with this primitive religion and primitive science it's a problem in and of themselves. But the real problem is you can't have philosophy founded on these. You can't bring them together logically with these false assumptions. It breaks down.
Yeah, they're all disjoint.
Yeah.
Like science.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you get into a mode where things are, you're allowing magic, it's all going to fall apart. There's no way to maintain some overall integrity, with all of this. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I keep sort of harping on this, because this is not just, I'm not just trying to get you to not rationalize interesting pictures with black holes or get you to rationalize the nucleus of the atom, something besides the strong force or whatever. I mean, I know that you're not immediately interested in that, and this isn't a science lecture, okay? But it's important to understand that, you do want to achieve God-knowingness.
Yes, sir.
Think about that second word. Knowingness. Okay? That involves a scientific foundation. There's no knowledge unless there's a scientific nature to your mind. Right? You can't, as we've stressed so many times, you can't really get the God-knowingness on the sixth level of meaning if you don't have a solid scientific consciousness on the fourth level of meaning. Right? You can't really have that religious consciousness on the sixth if you don't have scientific consciousness on the fourth. That scientific consciousness on the fourth is not you're now an expert in human genetics and its relationship to cancer, or infrared photon emissions from active galactic nuclei, or no, it's not what we're talking about. Not that, right? But you have to have a solid grounding in facts, because God is a fact. Right? The sixth adjutant, and such things can get you beliefs about a notion of God, but not the fact of God. Let alone a knowingness upon that factual foundation. Right? So, it's important to let the basic essence and substance of science displace magic in your mind. Because the degree to which there's magic in your mind, there is God knowingness is impossible. Right? Just by definition. And so this is important, no matter what your interests, certainly what your professional interests are. I mean, it doesn't matter. You need cosmic consciousness
to find the real God. And that's a combination of material consciousness and spiritual consciousness, right? In a super additive combination. You can't get there with just spiritual consciousness. Doesn't matter, if Jesus emphasized he's your spiritual father, right? He's an individuality, is he not? Could my pure unity consciousness have a relationship to his individuality? No, I have to have at least some individuality consciousness to find an individual. In the perfect continuumness of pure unity consciousness, there is no individuals, not even infinite ones. You have to have the basic material consciousness, individuality consciousness, however you want to think about it, that scientific consciousness, in order to have, to pretend, eventually have God knowingness. Let's see here. Okay, what else do we have there? Notice how that paragraph starts out. Magic is natural to a savage. If it wasn't obvious already, so the ghost cult is natural, fetishism is natural, magic is natural, every planet inescapably, and every developing human has to go through this process. For you to get to science, you have to actually go through a magical mode in your development to get there. But eventually you leave childish things behind, like magic, and are an adult of God. Like we were saying, it's science, genuine science is not natural. So the moment we take our eye off the ball, we'll go to what's natural. Magic will be back. We love our magical objects now. Think about how much fascination, remember, and think about the literalness of fascination, it means charm, right? How charming those pictures of that supermassive black hole are to everyone, because it's like, it's a magical object. It's so fascinating, right? Everyone is agog.
So just out of curiosity, what was it?
Yeah, what is it really? See, there's a question. And,
though it's colored in by computers, so it's hard to say.
You know that there's something non-luminous, at the center of a radiating region of gas. Is it an object? Is it a presence that's squelching? It's one thing to talk about a stellar mass black hole, okay, and it really isn't a black hole. It's a stellar mass dark gravity body. You can obviously have bigger dark gravity bodies, but if you're talking about something that supposedly is billions of solar masses, maybe it's not any sort of a dark island of space. After all, where is this thing? This is out in the first outer space level. Right? All the galaxies out there have associate transcendental master force organizers resident in them. Do they not? Mm-hmm. What kind of impressions, what kind of shadows might they leave? Right? There's not to mention all the things that they're doing that we're clueless about. Right? It may not necessarily be any sort of immediacy of their presence that you're seeing that light can't escape from. So after all, that's one of the reasons why those galaxies are more redshifted than they ought to be, because of the respiration. It's because it's harder for photons to escape their active presence as they leave those galaxies. They might not escape at all from their very immediate focus of their presence. Yeah. That's one possibility. or, you know, just the whole process of them coalescing the world and the force charge into automatons might have some sort of focus of quiescence or something. I don't know. I don't know this physics. But, you know, it has something to do with them, not magic objects that result from false initial assumptions, right? If you start with the magical assumption that extension, space, and time are realities, well, that defective magic is cured by more magic, black holes. let's see here. We are definitely not going to get to the end of the paper. Let's see. Okay, let's look at some of those things. You know, again, I told you they were going to mention this in passing, what we spent so much time talking about with mind-dominating matter. He believes that an enemy can actually be killed by practicing sorcery on his shingled hair or fingernail trimmings. All right? You know, and again, the fatality of snake bites, okay, you know, was attributed to the magic of the sorcerer. I mean, because again, there is, they don't think in terms of physical causality.
It's not the snake.
Right, it's not poison or, you know, snake venom, or I mean, you know, in some physical causality way like we think of it, right?
They used to have the venom as an elixir, didn't they? Yeah. They burned that book and now they didn't.
Well, yeah, there's just, obviously there's all this complexities, you know. And like I said, see, the difficulty in combating magic arises from the fact that fear can kill. Or, like I was saying, or belief can heal.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, the more, yeah, if it's a gross physical problem, like I always say, if my arm is hanging at a right angle, I can't just believe, you know, and the arm lifts up and glues back together and, you know, knits. No, that's not going to happen. My mind doesn't dominate matter to that degree, right? There's limits. But my mind could rearrange molecules and get rid of cancer, theoretically. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, mind is completely controlling the forms of the cells to begin with. Right? That's not beyond the realm of possibility. That's, you know, that's, we're kind of right in the wheelhouse of what the mind is doing already. You know, and then if the problem isn't really physical, if the problem is mindal to begin with, well, how straightforward it is for you to reform your mind, you know, and ta-da, that, you know, that malformation in your mind is gone. Or maybe I should say ill formation in your mind is gone. And the degree to which that ill formation in your mind was having physiological ramifications, okay, those are going to disappear too. You know, your you know, intestinal issues will go away or whatever. Because again, the only reason the intestines function and are shaped that way and everything is because mind is over controlling the whole phenomenon. Right, that, you know, it's just so important to not lose sight of that. Let's see. Okay, yeah, we talked about everything here. So let's we've got a little bit of time. Let's get a little ways into magical charms here. Yep.
You're not advocating not going to cancer treatments.
Of course, I'm not advocating not going to cancer treatments because, you know, they're holding up the fact that science was a big improvement over trying to just think your way through it and, you know, maybe thinking better because of your belief in magic or something. No, you want to use science to limits, but, you know, don't lose sight of how important your mind is. I mean, instead of just using chemicals to stop smoking, try using your mind. What's the worst thing that could happen? It doesn't work, and so you try some chemicals, okay? But maybe your mind can just, you know, move your body off that spot.
Well, they've done a bunch of studies at Harvard on what they call the effectiveness of prayer. But and the interesting thing was they had three studies. One is they would not pray for people. The other is they would pray for people and not tell them. And the other is they would pray for people and tell them.
Yep.
And the results of the third were so much greater than the results of the second, which were quite a bit greater than the results of the first.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, there's obviously, you know, this in a way, that's sort of proof that, yes, you know, when you really believe that you're being cured, then maybe that's part of...
Yeah, there's just, it's a very...
How often did Jesus say, it's your faith that healed you?
Yeah. And again, it's very, very complicated. I mean, it's because there's so many variables, you know, to this.
You hear
but
about it all the time.
You know, and it's going to work better for some individuals than others. You know, who have a great, you know, tighter connection between their mind and their body. And I mean, it's right. It's a very, very complicated thing. But to assume that there is no impact of mind on body is absurd.
So you think when we get to advanced light and life, there's more impact?
Yeah. I mean, when you have a genetically,
right, to start out,
for lack of a better word, let's say purified, don't take that too oddly, purified body, you know, and the mind that is naturally seated on that and all of the wonderful taking delight in cultivating that you've done, you know, to improve the form of that mind beyond its starting point. Yeah, I mean, remember, you know, you're seeking the nature that you're seeking is triune. You're going to get three things all at the same time eventually, in fullness, not just health, not just sanity, not just happiness, but health, sanity, and happiness. Matter, mind, and spirit, right? They will come in their fullness together.
Even it's in this backward disease.
Yeah,
right?
Yep. Just like the grand universe, you know, when it's settled in light and life, the matter, the mind, and the spirit all come together as one. It's not like the spirit is already there and the matter's trying to catch up. No, spirit isn't there, mind isn't there. All three of them are moving towards you know, that completed state, and the more they move towards that, the more they come together as a triune system and not three parallel parts.
Yeah. Maybe the description of the genetics would be more of a balanced genetics instead of a pure genetics.
Right. Yeah, well, it's, you know, I mean, I said purification because, you know, right now there's just so many issues that we haven't been purged of yet, either by biologic uplift or genetic engineering.
Because it'll be a new balance of a whole variety going together.
Yeah.
You know, of course, part of that is, you know, cleaning out, but there's also, you know, embracing many different.
Right. I mean, like I said, we don't need to. Yeah, you get the idea, right? Of just how sophisticated and holistic, you know, this state that we're talking about is.
Heard you say well genetics before.
Yes, right. You know, eugenics is well genetics. Right. There will be well genetics, you know, and in the wholeness of that word, well.
This is probably the reason why Oral Roberts did so well.
Okay, let's see if we can get a little bit more here.
Section 5, Magical Charms. Since anything connected with the body could become a fetish, the earliest magic had to do with hair and nails. Secrecy attendant upon body elimination grew up out of fear that an enemy might get possession of something derived from the body and employ it in detrimental magic. All excreta of the body were therefore carefully buried. Public spitting was refrained from because of the fear that saliva would be used in deleterious magic. Spittle was always covered. Even food remnants, clothing, and ornaments could become instruments of magic. The savage never left any remnants of his meal on the table. And all of this was done through fear that one's enemies might use these things in magical rites, not from any appreciation of the hygienic value of such practices.
But, coincidentally, there was a measure of hygiene nonetheless, right? We progress in spite of ourselves. You know, as a young boy, you may have had that habit of when you spit in the dirt to kick some dirt over the spit and cover it up, or where all these things come from, that you maybe never even thought about, including secrecy attendant upon bodily elimination, right? We have all these notions about why we do that, why we close the bathroom door or have a bathroom or whatever, right? And we have all these fancy notions of why we do that. Okay, but really, that all got started because, we didn't, if someone found this excreta, you didn't want them to be able to figure out whose it was. Because if they knew whose it was, then they could use it as magic against you. Or how handy it would be to, instead of having it all over the place, we could put it all in one spot and it's all mixed together, and then no one can figure out whose is whose.
Yeah. That's why they call it holy shit.
do you see how, think about how, all this, all of our gears, things like hygienic, okay, that's science. All of our scientific gears started to turn because of these magical thoughts. And then you bring in all sorts of, etiquette issues and whatnot as well. And again, I'm not saying we should toss out secrecy attendant upon body of elimination, right? but it's interesting to just keep in mind about how because all this stuff is natural, it's a vast conspiracy, right? Even if there isn't planetary prints in their staff there to teach people directly, they will slowly get some of this stuff because they'll have notions about magic and they'll connect it to the mystical things about body, stuff. And see how that even when there's a rebellion, there's a backup plan. The natural process with all of its superstitions and stuff steps in, and the time scale's a lot longer, but it works.
So what mind is behind thinking all, creating all that, creating the process that you just talked about, you go through? So this process, which evolutionary process, I guess, you're saying you back into these things from things that...
Yeah, the reason that the parts mysteriously end up doing things that the parts in and of themselves don't seem to have any reason to be doing is because parts exist in the context of a whole, right? The wholeness of mind it leads to this vast conspiracy of the parts. The parts can't help but work in the system of the wholeness of mind because it's all encompassing. So, that's how the conspiracy is implemented from the top down of mind. And it doesn't matter if it's engaging spirit stuff or matter. Wholeness of mind from the top down encompasses it, and there's this vast conspiracy of matter and spirit stuff to coincidentally work to greater ends that it would never do in and of itself.
Coincidentally.
Yes, coincidentally, quote unquote. Right. And of course, in the fullness of, the supremacy of that wholeness.
Right, that's
what we're saying. No matter how high the finite part, there's a supremacy to the wholeness. So it's just, the conspiracy is inescapable.
Magical charms were concocted from a great variety of things. Human flesh, tiger claws, crocodile teeth, poison plant seeds, snake venom, and human hair. The bones of the dead were very magical. Even the dust from footprints could be used in magic. The ancients were great believers in love charms. Blood and other forms of bodily secretions were able to ensure the magic influence of love.
Okay, do you see what's happening? Like I said, back at the very beginning, we're getting more abstract here. See, before we were thinking in literal fetishistic terms that there was a spirit being possessing, some object. We're kind of moving away from that. We're kind of sort of just taking the essence of that. It's like, no, it magic is within it instead of a being within it. See, we're getting, we're getting more abstract here. That's what you know, and that's that makes it more you know, more ripe with potential to get somewhere more real eventually. When you divorce it of kind of literal superstitious objects and just get it in more into the conceptual realm, you know, the concept is more liquid, right? And again, can be morphed more easily, right? So, you know, we don't necessarily have fetish charms. See, we have magic charms. You know, there's just magic in them instead of a being within them.
Lucky charms are nice.
See, the bones of the dead were very magical. See, and initially they were very magical because, well, there's a, you know, a magical spirit being in it, in the bones. But eventually, no, there's just magic in the bones. See, you've abstracted that. And then, of course, yeah, I mean, the whole magic influence of love, you know, see how we're getting very stuck down there on the first and second levels of meaning with L-O-V-E. It's been very difficult for us to lift that word above those levels. I mean, you know, two young people, you know, meet, get very excited and quote unquote fall in love and say to each other, I love you, I love you. Okay, well, probably what they mean is, I'm feeling the mating urge relative to you. Okay, which is a powerful and distinct feeling, you know, relative to lesser feelings, you know. And we all talk about the power of love, right? That feelings relative to that urge, you know, can move mountains, as it were, okay? And they at least are probably bringing in the affectionate feelings. You know, they aren't just literally thinking about the level of the flesh. But, you know, we still say, you know, they made love. Right? Which doesn't have anything to do with feelings. That's the level of the flesh stuff. Right? That's just the body moving relative to the instinctive urges in our adjutants. Yeah. So do you mean that just their bodies move in a certain way when those lower urges are moving them? Or do you go a step above that and say, no, I have feelings too, and that's what I mean by love? You know, and have you ever thought about taking it higher than that? Like, how many levels higher? 4 levels higher.
One at a time.
What's natural?
Yeah.
And when what's natural feels makes you feel good,
mm-hmm.
you love that.
Yeah, quote unquote makes you feel good. What's natural makes you quote unquote feel good, right? See, again, if I feel pleasant, you know, feelings, that is the definition of goodness. If I feel unpleasant feelings, that's the definition of badness. Right, we're just very stuck down and rationalizing down there. And again, because we're down there, the whole notion of what God is about or angels is about is dealing with our issues on the first and second levels of meaning, our flesh issues and our feeling issues. Right? I mean, when was the last time you prayed for something that wasn't related to a flesh issue or a feeling issue? Think about it.
Pray about it.
All right, keep going.
Well, it's funny that you know, they don't have a causal relationship with snake bites
mm-hmm.
physically.
Yeah.
But here, you know, they recognize that snake venom is
more
poison plant seeds.
Has a lot of them have mojo, yes. Yeah. 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 Right. So yeah, anything that's, you know, that's very definitive is going to be the object of lots of rationalization in all sorts of different ways. Yeah.
Images were supposed to be effective in magic. Effigies were made, and when treated ill or well, the same effects were believed to rest upon the real person. When making purchases, superstitious persons would chew a bit of hard wood in order to soften the heart of the seller.
Right, this whole imitative thing. See, is a point out that made a huge impression. That concept of imitative, like that. So you more and more you acted out this physics that you believed in, and how this works. You know, just the very fact that there's effigies. See, you're actually getting to, this is getting, laying the seeds for Aristotle to be able to actually finally recognize that there's sort of four causes, right? That there's a formal cause eventually, that there's form. See, you know, you're not just thinking about the matter itself, but you're starting to begin to think about what's form. Maybe it just is initially, you know, simple, like boundary or something, you know, but you're beginning to move towards that, you know, abstracting form from matter. And so all this stuff is, you know, is moving us towards higher thoughts.
The milk of a black cow was highly magical. So also were black cats. The staff or wand was magical, along with drums, bells, and knots. All ancient objects were magical charms. The practices of a new or higher civilization were looked upon with disfavor because of their supposedly evil magical nature. Writing, printing, and pictures were long so regarded.
Okay, yeah, you know, obviously anyone that writes is an evil empire. Or even the great Satan, maybe. All those notions, I was just about to go to the cow thing, all those notions, including the notions about cows. Yeah, and the hilarious thing, of course, is you can't help but think about, you know, how they're focusing on black cows as being, you know, the milk being highly magical. Now, are we in a better or a worse state today when you go out on the street and ask people, where does chocolate milk come from? And they say it comes from black cows, and white milk comes from, you know, brown cows. Okay, I mean, is that better or worse than thinking that the milk of a black cow was highly magical?
In this day and age, it's worse.
At least, right, at least back then, they knew that white milk came out of a black cow. Because they'd actually checked. Okay, you know, we've got lots and lots of people in this country that think that's where chocolate milk comes from. Right, so they're that divorced from fact. You know, all they know is you've got two kinds of cartons, you know, like red and white ones and brown and white ones. And you open the brown and white carton and it has chocolate milk in it because they milk the black cow. That's what they think. How could they not have seen like chocolate mix and put two and two together? Well, you know, that would be using physical causality like these people didn't. See, it's natural to not put chocolate mix and white milk together and think that it results in chocolate milk. That's a natural mind. So we're slipping back into the natural state. You can see it so easily. And if you love chocolate, isn't chocolate milk magical compared to white milk? I mean, seriously. I mean, just. I mean, just think about how we talk about this stuff and whatnot. All right. So, You know, and of course, you know, we all know how drums and bells and knots and all that sort of stuff, you know, is continued forward into all sorts of religious practices. And even if it isn't religious, you know, you think about drumming as having some mystical power. You know, let's all get in the circle and drum because it has mystical power. I mean, we all think this way still.
The wand chooses the wizard.
Yes. Okay.
Primitive man believed that names must be treated with respect, especially names of the gods. The name was regarded as an entity, an influence distinct from the physical personality. It was esteemed equally with the soul and the shadow. Names were pawned for loans. A man could not use his name until it had been redeemed by payment of the loan. Nowadays, one signs his name to a note. An individual's name soon became important in magic. The savage had two names. The important one was regarded as too sacred to use on ordinary occasions. Hence the second or everyday name, a nickname. He never told his real name to strangers. Any experience of an unusual nature caused him to change his name. Sometimes it was in an effort to cure disease or to stop bad luck. The savage could get a new name by buying it from the tribal chief. Men still invest in titles and degrees. But among the most primitive tribes, such as the African Bushmen, individual names do not exist.
Yeah. They always like to remind us of just, you know, what a spectrum we have on this planet, you know, from the most insanely primitive states, you know, all the way to, you know, desirous of light and life. Yeah, and just look at all the things there of, you know, Bob would never let anyone know that he's Robert. Yeah. All right? Because if they knew he was Robert, yeah, then, you know, they could use that in a magical spell. And, you know, if you're, like you're saying here, if you thought about it, you know, if you're sick, try changing your name. Why don't we just advocate the old school here?
we'll be back in vogue pretty
soon. Because obviously someone learned your name, and you know they've got a sorcerer working on you. That's why you're sick. I mean, just change your name, and it'll break the spell. Yeah, and you know, we all know about, you know, this whole bit of names and how it goes to the names of the gods.
It could be covered by your insurance.
You know, you can't say Yahweh, right?
Now it's change your password.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if something is unpleasant that is happening, you're pretty sure that someone has gotten your password, and so you instinctually now change your password, yeah, like changing your name. Rather than trying to figure out causally, well, is it really that? I mean, is changing my password actually going to solve the problem? It's like, yeah, you just do it anyway because, you know, just want to be safe, you know. It's a magical thought.
Computer's got a virus.
Right, I mean, just think about how we think this way still, and you gotta love the one about names were pawned. So that's why I have to sign a loan form. It's because they now possess my name, and I can't use it until I pay back the home loan. What else? Fun things that we have there. Let's see here. Oh yeah. The funny one. The savage. Yeah, of course. The savage could get a new name by buying it from the tribal chief. Oh, that's a racket! What a cool racket to have set up. You know, and of course the elites are still trying to dream up schemes like this. You know, like, you really need to have a degree, or, you know, you can't expect to get any sort of a job with any sort of a high pay. And it's going to cost you big bucks, okay? Tuition is $500,000 a semester. And
but here again, you really want to go back to where nobody wants to get educated.
Yeah, I know, right? But see, that's the whole thing. But you know, it's just, you know, we obviously don't want to go back where no one gets educated. But just notice how we are. We have this game we're playing with us, you know, that we don't naturally want to educate ourselves, but we'll go through a lot of pain and agony to educate ourselves if we get to put those letters after our name and everyone goes, ooh.
As if by magic.
Right? So, yeah, and it's like, it seems sad, but, well, okay, but at least people are educating themselves. Now, of course, it becomes problematic if the educational institutions have totally collapsed like they have now, right? But it's a way where even though it has selfish desire, right? You know, vanity. You know, people were educating themselves. You know,
hopefully enough to know the milk. Chocolate milk
doesn't come from black cows. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
They're not educating themselves.
Yeah, and if only those were, you know, like 3-year-old kids that they were asking, you know, where does chocolate milk come from? And it's like, no, those are college students. I mean, they're on the road to getting a college degree. Not only did they graduate from high school, oh my, you know, yeah, you know, we all know how, you know, it's endless the things that a college student, you know, thinks. You know, when did the United States start? I think that was 1960, wasn't it? You know, I mean, the things that'll come out of a college student's mouth, you know, but we're pretty certain that every younger kid should have the vote.
Let's lower the age.
Oh boy, don't get me started on that one, right? I mean, just the educational system, but anyway, back to the point. You know, this whole paragraph you see is as many examples of how we, you know, we had these silly superstitious notions and it led us to doing things in certain ways, some of which are kind of six of one, half a dozen another, others of which is, you know, were useful. You got some sanitation or whatever. So, you know, you got some education. So this is, you know, this is, again, just to, you know, to leave it there. All of that is fine in its place and in its time. But obviously the fifth epical revelation is laying all this out because it's trying to get you to see if you can imagine something greater. Something beyond this old mode, which is so self-serving. And we only progress in spite of ourselves. What would a world look like if the individuals were adults of God, and they were mostly unnatural instead of mostly natural? All right. Well, we'll finish this up on sort of like the science of magic, if you will, the practice of magic here next time. And then
get into sinning, right?
Right. Then you see what we get into next. Now we start to get, you know, after that we'll get into the meaty stuff. Sin, sacrifice, and atonement. Pardon the pun with the meaty stuff, because we're going to talk about cannibalism. all right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.